I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Elchanan Miller, Arab affairs journalist, rabbinical student, creator of the People of the Book YouTube series discussing Arab-Jewish relations. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mavina in Israel, Oshrat Borel, and our Shinchanim Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Purim is coming up this week, Wednesday night and Thursday, bringing joy and hamantashen into all of our lives. While Purim is the silliest Jewish holiday and in many ways the most fun, it is often neglected by adults as being just a kid's festival. That's a shame, because the truth is, we need our religious life to be both serious and meaningful and fun, if not always at the same time. Judaism has always understood this and has incorporated into its annual calendar both the overwhelming seriousness of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and the ridiculous frivolity of Purim, the Feast of Esther. And in a subtle way, it has chosen to make them polar opposites, twin festivals almost exactly 6 months apart, half a year, with completely reversed traditions and practices. The parallels, or rather the reversals, are fascinating. Beginning with their placement on the calendar, they include food, dress, music, and seriousness. On Yom Kippur, we fast. On Purim, we feast. On Yom Kippur, we are to be deeply serious, while on Purim, we are supposed to revel and be as silly as possible. On Yom Kippur, we dress in all white, while on Purim, we dress in colorful costumes of every style and construction. On Yom Kippur, we pray all day. On Purim, we perform plays and parodies, have carnivals and celebrations, play games of chance. On Yom Kippur, we are not to drink at all, not even water. On Purim, we're commanded to drink alcohol, ad lo yada, until we can't tell the difference between the evil Haman and the good Mordechai. On Yom Kippur, we read Torah portions of sanctity and atonement. On Purim, we read the Book of Esther, a wild, rollicking tale in which God's name is not even mentioned. If holidays were human beings, Yom Kippur would be Mother Teresa. Purim would be Charlie Sheen or Rob Gronkowski. These holidays could not be any more different, and both still be Jewish. Yet oddly, the mystics in Judaism saw in Purim a similarity to Yom Kippur. They noted that Yom Kippur, called in Hebrew Yom HaKippurim, can be translated as Yom Kippurim, the day like Purim. And not only Kabbalists saw it that way, so did the noted anti-mystic, the Vilna Gaon. The reasoning of these great minds on the subject is certainly complex. As one rabbi wrote, "We would assume Yom Kippur is the greater of the 2 days, but in one sense, Purim is even greater. It's easier to achieve spiritual elevation on a day like Yom Kippur when we pray and have no time for forbidden activities like gossip or getting angry. By fasting, the soul achieves dominance over the body, but on Purim, in our state of rambunctious drunkenness, it is much harder to maintain our human dignity." No kidding. As Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov writes, "If one attains holiness through affliction and another attains holiness through indulgence, who is the greater of the two? It may be said that the one who attains holiness through indulgence is greater, for the attainment of holiness through indulgence requires an infinitely greater degree of striving and effort. In this way, the challenge of Purim is greater. Literally translated, Yom HaKippurim is only a day like Purim." Okay, frankly, I don't buy it. To me, Purim is much more a reflection that people need humor and joy at least as much as they need serious introspection. Purim comes to teach us that even the Holy Blessed One likes a good party now and again. Like all the other springtime festivals, whether we call them Mardi Gras, Spring Fling, or Rodeo, Purim is a lot of fun, a great way to usher in the end of winter with a wild, over-the-top, rambunctious celebration. Inhibitions are out, revelry, for one night and day at least, is in. It's as though we've been good for so long, we need to let down our hair, change our clothes, really celebrate. There's a 9-word summary for every Jewish festival from Hanukkah through Pesach. They tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. On Purim we add, and drink. Pure, irresponsible fun, right? But there's also something more profound going on at Purim than just a good, unwholesome time. There's a famous joke that says on Purim we Jews dress up and pretend to be non-Jews, while on Yom Kippur we dress up and pretend to be Jews. Purim is here to remind us that Judaism, our own Judaism, your Judaism, can be, should be, enjoyable and meaningful. That being Jewish is a gift and a blessing and a rollicking good time. And so to get us in the Purim mood, here's cantor Paul Zim singing La Yehudim Haita Ora V'Simcha. The Jews had light and joy on Purim.
La Yehudim Haita Ora, La Yehudim Haita Ora, La Yehudim Haita Ora V'Simcha V'Sasam V'Kar. La Yehudim Haita Ora, La Yehudim Haita Ora, La Yehudim Haita Ora V'Simcha V'Sasam V'Kar. Ken, ken tiyeh lanu, ken, ken tiyeh lanu, ken, ken tiyeh lanu, ken tiyeh lanu, ken, ken tiyeh lanu, ken, ken tiyeh lanu, ken, ken tiyeh lanu, ken tiyeh lanu. La Yehudim Haita Ora, La Yehudim Haita Ora, La Yehudim Haita Ora V'Simcha V'Sasam V'Kar. La Yehudim Haita Ora, La Yehudim Haita Ora, La Yehudim Haita Ora V'Simcha V'Sasam V'Kar.
That was Paul Zim singing La Yehudim Haitorah V'Simcha for Purim coming up this week, Wednesday night and Thursday. Our guest this morning, Elchanan Miller, is a prominent Arab affairs journalist, a modern Orthodox egalitarian rabbinical student, and the creator of the remarkable new People of the Book YouTube series that explains Judaism to the Arab-speaking world. We'll hear all about that unusual effort and his take on Arab-Jewish relations today when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Elchanan Miller is a journalist specializing in Arab, Israeli, and Arab-Jewish relations. He's been an Arab affairs reporter for the Times of Israel, among other publications, and has a remarkable YouTube series explaining Judaism to the Muslim world. Good morning, and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks, Rabbi Cohen.
I should have also mentioned you're a rabbinical student. Maybe we'll start backwards. What led you to that?
I've always been dabbling and interested in Jewish content. I had a modern Orthodox upbringing in Jerusalem, where I live and grew up, and studied in yeshivas for a bit, and most recently discovered a new program in Jerusalem called Beit Midrash Har'el. It's an ordination program which is modern Orthodox but also egalitarian. So when the opportunity arose, it seemed like the right thing for me right now.
Yeah, it's a fascinating new aspect of the Orthodox world with the ordination of women in various rabbinical roles. Tell us what, this is too global a question, but in the Arab world, the understanding of Judaism is often filtered through the Quran. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad, who lived in Arabia in the 7th century, was exposed to Jews as a merchant. And the Quran, as it was shaped, is filled with Jewish material that Muhammad or the people around him picked up, whether it be stories from the Torah, the Bible, Midrashic stories that are later Jewish texts. And so Islam has a lot to say about Jews and Judaism. In both negative senses and positive senses. That is, at first Muhammad tried to bring the Jews closer to Islam and bring them into the fold. The Jews, according to the Islamic narrative, rejected all of this, and then there was a falling out, and Islam became negative about Judaism. So a lot of the stereotypes and ideas about Judaism are negative, with some positive there too. So today, you know, Muslims can choose which to lean on when they think about Judaism. But unlike Judaism, that has very little to say about Islam, Islam has a whole lot to say about Judaism. So there's a certain imbalance there.
And part of the reason you started this YouTube video series was to explain Judaism in more accurate, clearer terms?
Yeah. I mean, I've been, you know, meeting Palestinians and Muslims more broadly for the last few years, both as a journalist and before then as a student in Jerusalem with dialogue groups here in the city. And the questions always come up as to what Jews believe in, even sort of simple things like why they dress a certain way, why they eat certain foods and not others, what are the tenets of their faith, how do those beliefs interact with Islamic beliefs. And the climax of this process was last year when I was asked to teach a series on basic Judaism to Palestinians in the West Bank, in Gush Etzion, the settlement block just south of Jerusalem, and also about Islam to the settlers living in that area, the Israelis. And I heard questions that were very basic about Judaism, as I just described, and I figured why not expand the audience that's listening to these questions from the, you know, dozen that were listening to me there to the millions of Arabs living in the area and even over 1.5 billion Muslims living all over the world. And I thought that the best way of doing that would be through social media, which I'm an avid consumer of myself, and I use as a journalist too. So then the challenge was finding the exact way to do this. And finally, I stumbled across a very good animation design firm here in Jerusalem, and the partnership began there this last summer.
Well, we will talk much more about that, as well as about the perception of Jews among Israelis among Palestinians when we come back with Elchanan Miller here on Too Jewish in just a moment. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, twojewishradio.com, streaming it from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started speaking last week, it spoke for a while, about the Jewish community in Germany and particularly in Berlin, which is now a vital and growing part of the Jewish world, as stunning as that may seem. Extraordinarily diverse community. Let's go a little further there.
Well, two main things that I want to underscore that we didn't even approach last week are the fact that probably the world's best Jewish museum is in Germany, and it's in fact West Berlin, fairly near where Checkpoint Charlie used to be. It attracts people from all over Germany who want to learn about German Jewish history in particular and what happened to the Jews of Germany and why did it happen. And they're very curious, but also international visitors. And there's two completely separate reasons for the attractiveness of this museum. One is the building itself, which was designed by Daniel Libeskind, who won the right to do that in a hotly contested international competition. The building is stunning, unforgettable. It's a bit like the Guggenheim in Bilbao, but it's also very controversial because there are many who argue that the design of the building is completely unrelated to the content of the building. Nobody disputes that the content is excellent. They dispute the space into which the content was put. There's lovely gardens, there's a cafe, a gift shop, whatever. I mean, you could spend a day there easily. Wow. And that's one of the main attractions of Jewish life, in addition to lots of like kosher restaurants, and as I said last week, a wide variety of synagogues and temples and whatever. It's Jewish like the diversity,
centers.
Right. And the fact that they ordain rabbis and rabbis from other places in the region can go and study there. German is still in many parts of what used to be the Habsburg Empire, either the first tongue or the second tongue of many people who would not define themselves as Germans or carry a German passport. But it's a very widely spoken language in much of Eastern Europe. All right. So in addition to that is the fact that Berlin in particular has a long tradition of tolerance and being welcoming and multicultural and diverse and cosmopolitan. So during the war, a lot of Jewish couples throughout Europe, including places like Vienna, sent their small children to Berlin in hopes that they would survive. And a lot of non-Jews took small children, adopted them, claimed that they were their own, and you know they just lost the papers or whatever. And many of those children survived the war, including a woman who, when I lived and worked in Vienna, was the vice chair of the Austrian parliament. And she knew her roots. She knew that she was really Jewish, even though she was raised by a Protestant family in Berlin. And she knew exactly how and why she survived the war. Her family didn't, those who stayed behind in Vienna. But there's hundreds of stories like this of people who were sent to Berlin to survive the war, because actually Berlin is one of the only places in Germany, if not the only place, where a synagogue survived the war intact. It wasn't destroyed. The interior was looted. It didn't function as a synagogue for a long time, but eventually it returned to its original purpose.
Amazing stories. And, you know, it seems strange to go to Germany to see Judaism, but in fact, that's what a lot of people are doing now, and it's well worth doing.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
As part of our pre-Purim show this morning, here's a wonderful Sephardic Purim song, Empezar a Contar, the story of Purim as told in a poem. This is a setting from the Jews of Sarajevo. Thank you. That was the Purim song in Bazar HaKontar, a Sephardic song for Purim. It's coming up this Wednesday night and Thursday. We welcome one of our Shin Shinim, Tamir Shukuri. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
You have returned from a visit home to Israel not too long ago, and one of the things you did was take some of your pre-testing for the Army. You're here, of course, on your Shnat Shirut, on your year of service before you go into the Army. Tell us a little bit about that process and how it all works.
So the Army in Israel is a very complex and important industry, and I think that in order to make it efficient, then they do standard testing for everyone in the country. So when you're in 10th grade, you get your first basic testing for the Army, and you get three different grades. So the first grade is about your health situation.
Basic physical fitness and any medical issues that you might have.
Mm-hmm. And the second grade you get is after you do a test on the computer. It's basically, it looks like an IQ test, but it also has Hebrew texts and sometimes English and math.
So it's like an IQ test with a little bit of SAT thrown in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a nice combination,
right?
And then you get one final grade that is kind of a combination of both of these, and also your situation in your family, where you live, and where you went to school.
It's like a psychological profile.
Yes, that is a good explanation of that. So after you get those three grades, you just depend on luck, and you hope you get the role that you wanted. And for girls, you also do another day. It's called Yom HaMe'a, and it's a day where they get extra grades for leadership, for cooperation, physical abilities. And after that, you get a better picture of what everyone wants and fit into the Army, because the Army has many different roles.
So, all right, this is a difficult question for you. You know, you're going in for a 3-year stint in the Army. What is it you want to do, or what do you think you want to do?
So, quite honestly, I'm not really sure. The Army has a lot to offer. I was thinking about doing something in journalism or maybe something in cyber. I'll see what the Army has to offer, and I'll see if I pass the tests myself. And I just think that it's so amazing how much the Army grew in terms of how many different positions there are. You can be an Army DJ, Army magician, Army singer, Army whatever. So, yeah.
So, one more thing. Women now have, there's been in the news again, a larger combat role. They've been in combat roles in the IDF, but that's increased. Tell us a little bit about what that change has meant.
That's right. So, for me, personally, I know three girls that are right now serving as in a combat position, and I think it's so amazing to see the growth and to see how much women are really fighting to get into a combat position, although it's very, very hard. The training is very hard, and I just think that it's amazing that they want to be seen as equals, and they want to contribute to the country.
I think you noted that there's been a tremendous increase. What's the increase in the number, since they've publicized opening up more units, what's the increase in the number of women who have volunteered or tried to get into these roles?
So lately, I've seen an article stating that in the past couple of years, the number of women that have joined as combat soldiers has risen by 400%.
Wow.
That's an amazing growth, and I think that also helps them later on in life, like it helps men that are joining as combat soldiers. You just come out of the Army prepared for life and ready for everything.
It's also an entree into some of the higher levels of Israeli society, to be honest. Thanks so much, Tamir. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Shabbos services have just finished. The congregation is invited to a kiddush. During the kiddush, Mordechai goes over to Rabbi Blum and shakes his hand. He says, "Rabbi, you gave a good sermon today. You should have it published." "Thank you," said Rabbi Blum. "But between you and me, I'm planning to have all my sermons published posthumously." "That's good news," says Mordechai. "The sooner the better." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Ki Tisah, the story of the golden calf. This is one of the most dramatic and, for the rabbis of the Talmud, distressing portions in the whole Torah. The problem is acute. According to the text of the Torah, our people witnessed the 10 plagues, are personally saved at the shore of the Sea of Reeds by God, received the direct revelation at Sinai, in short, experienced God more directly than any other group in history ever, and then almost immediately turn around and reject God to worship a cow made out of their own jewelry. No wonder the rabbis of the Talmud and Midrash called this week's events the Maaseh HaEgel, the awful story of the calf. How can a people given such a clear set of signs and wonders, even direct instruction and command, only follow God for 40 days before pursuing a weak and bovine substitute? The answer, to paraphrase Shakespeare, is not in our God, but in ourselves. We enjoy spectacle, are impressed by it, even awed by it, but as soon as it's gone, its effects linger a very short time. What makes us tick as human beings, what keeps us in line, is the very dailiness of regular observance, rules, schedules, of the kinds of laws and rituals that are very much a part of practical Judaism in subsequent eras. We need both ritual and structure, and until these are provided in a coherent way, we tend to flounder, even disastrously so, as we did at the time of the golden calf. The message is simply that we need more than grand ideas or sweeping spirituality. We need religion and a Jewish grounding in practice and experience, or we won't be able to remain both ethical and coherent. Without that focus, we begin to worship golden calves of every kind, from work to our pastimes to our often unfortunate obsessions with power or control or money. Try to incorporate a Jewish practice you have not previously done, a bit of Torah study, prayer, ritual, or tzedakah you haven't made a regular part of your life previously. Doing so will help you connect to the true God and avoid the danger of worshiping your own golden calf. When we return on Too Jewish, our guest, Elchanan Miller, will explain what many Arabs and other Muslims think about Jews and Judaism, and how his remarkable YouTube series about Judaism in Arabic is being received in the Arab world. Find out when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Israeli army provided intelligence that prevented a plot by the Islamic State to bomb an Australian flight last August. That information, provided by the IDF Military Intelligence Unit 8200, thwarted a planned attack. The unit provided exclusive intelligence. It led to the prevention of an air attack by the Islamic State in 2017 in Australia, an officer of the unit said. Foiling the attack saved dozens of innocent lives and proved Unit 8200's position as a major player in the intelligence fight against the Islamic State. Back in August, Australia arrested two men suspected of trying to carry out a plot to place an explosive device on an Etihad Airways flight leaving Sydney. Australian police called the attempted attack one of the most sophisticated plots that's ever been attempted on Australian soil. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu of Israel praised the intelligence unit's work. "This is just one of the dozens of terrorist attacks we have stopped around the world," he said. "The intelligence services deserve all the support we can give, not only for protecting the citizens of Israel, but for protecting people all over the world."
Quando le reni mirò dal campo salia, mirava e nel cielo e en la estreria, vido luz santa en la giuderia, che havia de nascer Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu, padre querido, padre bendito, luz de Israel. Avraham Avinu, padre querido, padre bendito, luz de Israel.
More than 525 years after expelling its Jews, Spain is officially recognizing Ladino as a Spanish tongue in the hope of saving the language of Spanish Jewish exiles from extinction. At a conference last week at the Royal Spanish Academy in Madrid, officials announced the establishment of a new Ladino Academy to be located in Israel. One of its goals will be to save Ladino from fading away, said Professor Shmuel Raphael, director of Bar-Ilan University's Salty Center for Ladino Studies. Ladino, also known as Judeo-Spanish, is a language preserved by Spanish Jews following their expulsion from Spain in 1492. It was the main tool for creating, disseminating, and preserving the spoken and written culture of the Spanish Jews, Raphael says. That's certainly true. Spain's decision derives from an understanding that Ladino is a Spanish language in the same way as Portuguese, Catalan, Basque, the Spanish dialect spoken in Argentina, Mexico, Venezuela, the Philippines, and elsewhere. Remember, there's no single form of Spanish throughout the world, says Raphael. One of the new academy's first tasks will be to put together a historical dictionary of Ladino that collects textual sources in the language from the many places where it's thrived in different periods. Also, with Ladino becoming an official language, Spain will be able to add Ladino words and phrases to its popular online historical dictionary for the benefit of the world's 500 million Spanish speakers. Ladino will join the international upsurge of the Spanish languages, and hundreds of millions of Spanish speakers all over the world will be able to learn about the culture of the Jews of Spain and what became of them, Raphael says. In Jerusalem, the impression of Prophet Isaiah's personal seal may have been found. Excavations in the Ophel, an area just below the Temple Mount, found the seal mark, a bulla is what it's called, in undisturbed Iron Age remains, 10 feet from where the bulla of King Hezekiah of Judah was found 3 years ago in 2015. This extraordinary object, estimated to be 2,700 years old, was discovered by Dr. Eilat Mazar of Hebrew University. She reported on her discovery last week in Bar, the Biblical Archaeology Review magazine. We appear to have discovered a seal impression which may have belonged to the prophet Isaiah in a scientific archaeological excavation, she said. Finders believe the bulla was discovered in situ, that is, undisturbed over all this time, 27 centuries, outside of what had been the ancient kingdom's royal bakery. Half an inch wide, the bulla bears the name Yeshayahu, the Hebrew name of Isaiah, in ancient Hebrew script, followed by the letters Nun, Vet, Yud, the first three letters of the word for prophet, Navi. Isaiah's period was also that of King Hezekiah, the 12th king of the kingdom of Judah. He ruled from around 727 BCE to around 698 BCE. Mazar points out that finding the bulla of the prophet right by that of the king should not come as a surprise given their symbiotic relationship as described in the Bible. And finally, six-time NBA All-Star Amari Stoudemire has launched a line of kosher for Pesach Israeli wines. The 6'10 Stoudemire spoke glowingly about the wines and his connection to Israel last week. It's a blessing for me and my family to be able to produce such great wines from a land like the land of Israel. So we're constantly counting our blessings for that, Amari Stoudemire said at the launch event at the Jewish National Fund House on the Upper East Side of New York. Stoudemire, who is 35 years old, said he had been in talks with the Israel Wine Producers Association for about 3 years to make an Israeli wine and realized the opportunity when he relocated to Israel in 2016 to play for the Israeli team Hapoel Yerushalayim, Hapoel Jerusalem. Stoudemire retired from basketball last year after helping lead Hapoel Jerusalem to the Israeli Basketball League Cup. Once I moved to Israel, it was a perfect connection to meet with the vineyards, go to the tastings, figure out the different blends for each bottle, said Stoudemire, part owner of Hapoel Jerusalem. Stoudemire starred for the New York Knicks and Phoenix Suns, among other teams, in a 16-year NBA career. Although he was raised a Christian, he began exploring a spiritual connection to Judaism on a trip to Israel in 2010. He publicly identifies as Jewish and is raising his children as Jews. Stoudemire's line includes two red wine blends and a Cabernet Sauvignon, all produced in limited quality by the Tulip Winery on its vineyards in Kfar Tikva in the north of Israel. The winery produced 100 bottles of a high-end wine, Stoudemire Private Collection. Each bottle retails at $245. Produced more of the Stoudemire Reserve and Stoudemire Grand Reserve wines, retailing at $60 and $100 respectively. The kosher beverage giant Royal Wine Corporation is distributing the wine, currently only available for purchase in stores in New York and New Jersey. Mari Stoudemire continues to speak about his connection to Israel. He said he's open to producing additional wines, but would not produce them outside of the Jewish state. I prefer to keep the wine strictly from the grapes in Israel, he said. It's my way of giving back to the land. I try to do what I can to stay rooted. Making sure the wine was kosher was important to the basketball star. Stoudemire identifies with the Hebrew Israelites, African Americans, who believe they are connected to the biblical Israelites and adhere to Jewish customs. A kosher wine is always important for us. You can drink those during the High Holy Days and Passover, he said. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Elchanan Miller is a Jerusalem-based journalist and Yerushalmi, and a rabbinical student who's specialized in the Arab world. He was trained in Arabic and Middle East politics, both in the Israeli Army, the IDF, and at Hebrew University. He comments and writes regularly on regional affairs in Arabic and English language media, and has a remarkable new series explaining Judaism to Muslims, an animated series, very entertaining one, even if I don't understand the Arabic, on YouTube. Tell us, in your perception, what changes you've seen in the Palestinian perceptions of Jews, of Israelis in the last several years, if that's not too broad a question.
I think one of the things that are interesting is how social media has affected the perception. So before social media sort of burst into our consciousness, the mainstream Arab media would filter things that were inconvenient to the narrative that was, you know, the pan-Arab narrative or the nationalist narrative. So a lot of information just wouldn't reach Palestinians or Arabs more broadly. Today we have this revolution where everyone's exposed to all the information. And I think more than for people in the West, for Arabs and Muslims, this is truly a revolution because they get much more information that's unfiltered than they used to get in the past. So it's good and bad. I mean, they get movies and clips and information like the kind I'm trying to produce, but they also get terribly vile, negative information that is sometimes skewed from other directions. And it's really a big question how they navigate that. I think it's probably true to say that many of the young perpetrators of attacks these days against Israelis are a very young demographic, 18 to 20, 21-year-olds, and they're heavily influenced, I would say, by information they get on social media. So it's really a matter of combating that and trying to create a more balanced perception.
You've said, you know, you're not doing Israeli Hasbara, you're not doing PR for Israel, and you're not. Explain to our audience the distinction between just simply the kind of work you're doing and what the Israeli government and other Israeli entities find themselves engaged in.
Well, I try to leave Israel really out of my project, which is called People of the Book, in Arabic, Ahlul Kitab, which is an Islamic reference to Jews and Christians. I really try to speak to my viewers as a Jew to a Muslim. I don't hide the fact that I'm Israeli and that I'm broadcasting or speaking from Jerusalem, but I don't see my mission primarily as one of explaining Israel or of showing Israel's positive parts, which I obviously believe in, but rather of approaching the conflict from the religious perspective or from our perspective as believers. And I feel that involving Israel too much or going too much into the current political questions would undermine that mission of mine. So I do answer some questions that have to do with what is Zionism or general questions like that, but I try not to get too much into the politics. Hasbara in general means, you know, government agencies in Israel and nonprofits try to highlight Israel's successes, I would say primarily in technology, but also some more hardcore Hasbara would be just trying to justify certain policies that are taking place today, many of which I don't personally agree with, so I would try to veer away of trying to justify some of the political policies that we see today.
As a journalist, and trained as a journalist, you report what you see. in explaining Judaism as you're doing through this, through the People of the Book series, how do you choose where to start?
So the first videos that I'm producing are focusing on things that we and Muslims have in common. In other words, things that are relatively light in nature, humorous, interesting. So my first video was about food, kosher food, halal, the similarities and differences between those two dietary laws. And then I moved on to prayer in my last video, which was uploaded in December. And my next video hopefully will be on clothing and dress. So the issues aren't that deep or that philosophical yet. And what I'm trying to do now at this point is create a common language or some sort of rapport between my viewers and myself and break down some of the hostility and the suspicion before going on to more sensitive issues like Jerusalem or, you know, prophecy or the idea of God, some heavier topics.
It's always seemed to me that as kind of legally oriented systems, Judaism and Islam are as close as any two religions could be in some areas. Do Muslims perceive that?
I think they do. Today I've been spending quite a bit of time reading comments on my YouTube channel. And many of the commenters just now, just today, have been commenting on how close the religions are. What I try to highlight is that they're both religions of halakha, or legal structures that navigate or that sort of regulate how the person, the believer, leads his life. And in that sense, I think they are very close. I personally believe that Judaism and Islam are the two closest religions, and I try to highlight those commonalities. So as I said, Muslims, I think, who know the religions pick up on that. Yet there's all this hostility and all this baggage that they take with them from their own texts, and that's something that's more difficult sort of to navigate or to explain.
Are people that show, I mean, because comments, I'm sure, in addition to the positive ones, like everybody on every social media channel, I'm sure you get some flames. Are people focusing on the Quranic and other Islamic texts that are anti-Jewish, or are they focusing more on contemporary political issues when they respond negatively?
I'd say it's a mix. I think a lot of the questions have to do with current practices or current beliefs. A lot of questions about the relationship between Zionism as a movement and Judaism. I would say that a lot of my viewers try to solve this cognitive dissonance that they encounter when they see a positive image or a positive figure like myself who does, you know, shows a pretty face of Judaism, and what all of their previous knowledge about what Israel does or what Zionism means to them. And then I see a lot of people trying to draw this distinction, saying not all Jews are Zionists. Zionism and Judaism are two completely different things. That's actually a tendency that I have tried to combat somewhat by saying that today most Jews in the world are Zionists to varying degrees with various definitions of what Zionism is. So that's one aspect of what I've been doing. But then there are other stereotypes that just repeat themselves a lot and that I've been aware of for many years, also studying Islam as a undergrad and graduate student at Hebrew University. For example, the stereotype of Jews as the killers of the prophets, and specifically the killers of their own prophets. And so there's this perception that since Jews as a collective are capable of such evil as killing their own prophets, then they're capable of any evil. And these are stereotypes that I don't even know how to begin to tackle and just try to sort of, I guess, explain them as I see them, where they came from, possibly from Christian anti-Semitic stereotypes, and try to explain to Palestinians or to Muslims why they believe certain things.
You have covered Palestinians, both Palestinian Authority, Palestinians within Israel, for a long time, and because of your fluency in Arabic, your ability to understand the culture is greater than most people, I would say. Currently, since Trump's declaration of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, has that had much impact on the Palestinian perspective on Israel, do you think?
I don't think it's had much impact. On the political level, it has by sort of verifying or vindicating what Palestinians thought about Americans anyway, or about the peace process anyway, which is that it was a sham, that Americans shouldn't have been trusted to begin with as the honest brokers to broker the negotiations. And that's a very powerful argument that people on the right, on the Palestinian right, like Hamas, are using to discredit people like Mahmoud Abbas, saying, you know, the Oslo process was ill-conceived and shouldn't have started. I'd say that on the more popular level, that isn't really happening. I think people look beyond that, and people, you know, haven't had high expectations of Israel or of the Americans, for that matter, for a long time. So I think this is sort of a little blip on the screen, but nothing more than that.
It's been my impression, but you're a lot closer to it than I. Do a couple of more questions sort of about your perceptions of Palestinians. Do Palestinians today have confidence in the Palestinian Authority?
I think generally speaking, today Palestinians are completely disillusioned with their own political system, be it Hamas or Fatah / the Palestinian Authority.
Right.
I think they're looking for other sources of leadership or no sources of leadership. I think they're just disillusioned with no prospect of elections anytime soon. I think there's a disconnect between the very narrow political echelon and the public. Unfortunately, there's also a disconnect between the populations. So most Palestinians today, especially the younger generation, doesn't get to meet Israelis or Israeli society that much, except for in the mixed cities like Jerusalem or some of the other areas. So unfortunately, the divide, I think, is growing deeper, especially among the younger generation.
Do you see areas of hope, of positive movement now?
Well, I see hope in this information revolution that I was talking about earlier. I think hopefully Palestinians, Muslims, will be much more discerning in the information they get. They won't easily be swayed or convinced by demagoguery. They'll just have many more sources of information to choose from. Now, I think it's anyone's guess where that will go. There's also a lot of confusion. But in terms of optimism, I guess on some level, the PA or the West Bank is doing economically better than it used to be doing. People's livelihoods are more or less guaranteed. But in Gaza, the situation is still very dire. So there's a huge discrepancy, huge gap between what's happening in the Gaza Strip and what's happening in the West Bank. And that worries me a lot, because I see Gaza as a continued source of violence, which Israel hasn't managed to really solve yet or even conceive of a strategy for.
I want to thank Elchanan Miller for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to see the people of the book and to find out more about you?
Well, People of the Book exists on Facebook. Just type People of the Book and look for a little caricature of a rabbi or of a Jew. And same for YouTube, People of the Book. All the videos are available both in English and in Arabic, so you don't have to just rely on the subtitles. You can find an English version. Hopefully French soon. It's pretty easy to find.
French.
For all those North Africans and Africans and, yeah.
Ah, sure. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi Cohen. Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be actor, writer, and director Ben Rimmelauer, discussing his new show about addictions and recovery and Judaism. And, of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning is a Purim song of the Jews of the Sephardic world, Kichlot Yeni, Bring Me Wine, Not Water, from the group The Voice of the Turtle, and their Purim recording, The Sword of the Dove. My friends, may you have a Chag Purim Sameach, a happy coming holiday of Purim this Wednesday night and Thursday, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. Kichlot Yeni, tereleni, Kichlot Yeni, tereleni, Kichlot Yeni, tereleni. Yachidum kishi zarim, shavtu shirim kifi sharim, male mayim, male mayim. Lechem la'ochel, lechim tamoech, machal lechem gila, nitbagbir lifne ha'miutan mayim, miutan mayim.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.